So Chazara, yay.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! Okay, so this putting together the Shirim this year was a lot more amorphous and more difficult to figure out what fit in it than it was last year. Last year we'd spoken about the factors that Poskim take in. Oh, I left that one in the Shirim. Look at that. Two of them. Oof. What factors Poskim take into account when they Poskim, which is, you know, as things go relatively, not easy, but it's, you know, it is easier to figure out what fits into that category because, well, Poskim are writing and hopefully in a somewhat systematic way and they have to make decisions and some of them are more transparent about the decisions than others, but Bigadol, Poskim are actually making decisions. They are the experts in Jewish law, and they're making decisions from the vantage point of expertise. So analyzing that is, well, not easy, at least is definable, or easier to define. Defining the role of lady in the halachic process was much harder. And basically, what we did was to try to carve out the place of non-poskim in the halachic process, and toch kedei doing that, to balance the values, the relative values of autonomy and authority, or autonomy and heteronomy, in the halachic process. I put most of the shirim here on this, but then I realized I left out three. So, but we'll talk about them all anyways. So we spoke about different issues that seem to relate to this question. Right? The first question that we dealt with the first 5 weeks, I think, was to what extent, what is the role of the laity when they don't poskim, right? Let's take a very simple case where poskim are poskining, non-poskim are not poskining, right? That division of roles is maintained. So the first question I want to ask is, even within that framework, what role does the laity have in psak? Is there influence on the halachic system still critical? So we argue that it was in many ways and on many levels. So the first one we said, right, let's take the absolute extreme, so to speak. Right, let's take a case where there's minimal influence, where the laity does not even attempt to poskin at all. Has no expertise, not in the Metzias and not in the Halacha, and really he's just going to ask a Shaila. So at that point, we're talking very, 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 very strong emphasis on the authority end of the spectrum. What value or what role does the Baal HaBayis still have? So there we said, well, there's a few, right? First thing we noted is that even if the posek is making the decision entirely on his own, he can choose to be transparent or not transparent. And if he's transparent, we noted that, right, the value of transparency, and we noted some examples of poskim who poskin with that type of transparency, even if the member of the laity, the non-posek, is not making any halachic decision whatsoever, he's still brought into the process. Right? Sometimes poskim choose to not even do that, but to Paskin to be totally opaque and not allow the person asking the question into their mind. At that moment, right, authority has really overwhelmed the role of autonomy. The person is not at all involved in the process. But despite that, we noted that the relatively effects of transparency can, you know, are not the same in all situations. Right? Sometimes there is a benefit towards providing transparency and the level of autonomy that comes with at least knowing what's going on in the halachic process. But sometimes that can be detrimental. for several reasons. One is that sometimes the best way to allow someone to make a decision is to not provide transparency, because if you provide transparency, sometimes people will not be able to act with the conviction that they could when you leave them out of the process. And sometimes you don't want that. Right? The extreme example that we brought of that was the psak of many of the Haredi poskim in the Ma'amar Yirat Torah in the context of OCD, We noted that Postgame there don't provide transparency on purpose, right? They say that if we were to explain the reasons to you, you would find a way around it, and that wouldn't help. In order to solve OCD in the area of religiosity, specifically it's called scrupulosity, so it's actually beneficial to being opaque. Another example, we said there's a benefit to that. We noted from the Rav's, for example, the Rav's letters on women's learning, that Psak can act to protect the person who's asking the shoel from critiques from others, right? At some level, giving up your authority within the halachic process grants you authority lemaisa, right? The fact that you were not part of the process means that you can now be shielded by the authority of the posek. Right, the Rav was basically doing that in the women's learning one, whereby saying, look, you have to agree to my psak no matter what, I won't paskin until you agree, and in his original letters, at least, not giving the reason, he really protected the shoalim from criticism and took it for himself. So the first thing we noted is that, right, that even when really it's totally clear that the posek is the one poskening and not the laity, right, there's still a decision to be made about to what level the laity is brought into the process through transparency. But we noted that, right, it's not always the case that granting someone authority of sorts within the halachic process gives them lemaisa more authority. Sometimes dafka forcing them to rely on authority is what gives them freedom in real life. Right. So that was the first thing we noted. The next several things we noted is that there, in addition to just that, you know, very minor level of autonomy, right, the autonomy to know what the process looks like and what it entails, there is real autonomy, there is real power in the hand of the shoalim, and that is in their role as the person choosing the posek. Right? We noted that normally, under halachically, right, you choose your posek, you choose your rav for a bunch of reasons. Right, there are benefits. You know, you choose a teacher to educate you, to help you clarify your own thoughts, to help you reveal bias, to help you ensure your internal consistency. And each of those roles, right, emphasizes different levels of authority or autonomy. But who, at any rate, you choose that Rebbe, you choose that posek. Now, one of the important things that we dealt with in that context was the question: Is this true? Right, one of the strong limitations on your ability to choose a posek is the category of Mardasra. Where, right, classically, the fact that the most authoritative posek in a given locale was the rabbi of that locale, and if you live there, he was your posek, does seem to highlight that under certain circumstances, you aren't even granted that level of autonomy. You aren't even granted the ability to choose your posek. But we noted that it goes back very, very far. Already the Rashba is treated like this, that the category of Marda Asra is not necessarily fundamentally tied to locale. And already the Rashba moves it in the direction of being someone you identify with. Now, admittedly, the Rashba's original tshuva are talking about a city choosing a posek ideologically as opposed to based on location, right? Like people in Svarad choosing the Rambam or choosing Shulchan Aruch. But that model already moves us away and says that even that classic model that seems to negate your ability to choose your own Rebbe, your own posek, is not actually true. Right? That Murda Asra, while pragmatically for much of history, did mean that wherever you happened to live, that was your posek. The category B'Ikaron didn't have to mean that. And the second you're open to the possibility that your Murda Asra could be the person you choose to identify with, the posek of a community could not be defined by, you know, Alon Shvut, but rather the Dati Lumi community, then even Murda Asra, which is the model that most moves away from personal choice, could then be returned to the world of personal choice, because obviously, once we're dealing on the level of ideology and identification, who one identifies is his own choice. Similarly, not just on the level of overarching psak, but even on the level of local psak, Right, we noted that on a case by case basis, the notion of binding psak, to the extent that it exists, according to pretty much everybody, only becomes binding when what? When you choose to ask a question. Now, why that works is an interesting question. And we saw that there were three positions. Is it about kavod? Is it about neder? or is it about creating a halachic status? Right? Why is it that when you ask a shayla, you can't then ask another posek, assuming you can't ask another posek, or why can another posek not weigh in? But whatever you think it is, it's clear that what creates that binding nature is your acceptance of the posek. Right, we saw that the formulation of Shal Yisraeli, he thinks the reason that it's binding and what all these in the end come down to is that at least for the purpose of this Shiloh, you've created a personal Rebbe, and that's why it is authoritative. But the fact is, in the end of the day, it's all totally in you asking the question. If that's the case, then that's why that explains why the post can say that it's only binding for this Shiloh, but not another one. Right? The whole point is that in order for a Shiloh to be binding, it needs to be asked. So, right, to summarize that unit and then bring the one case, test case that we brought in that unit, right, within the question of, within the cases where poskim really, where the lady is not attempting to poskim all, is not attempting to make decisions at all, we noted that there really is still a very strong role to balabatim, where there is a lot more authority than is seen at first glance. Both because they have the ability to choose their Rebbe in general, especially when we've moved away from locale-based Morad Asra to ideological Morad Asra, definitely on the level of individual Psak, where you have the possibility of turning to anyone who you happen to turn to, and it's only on that Shiloh that the answer is binding, because it is your initiative to ask that makes it binding, and that means that even within a place where you, who are not a posek, is not poskening at all, still there's a lot more room left to the initiative of the individual. We noted again that even once you ask that shayla, there is that choice of the posek of how much to bring you into the process through transparency or not. But we noted again that sometimes there are benefits to granting transparency and sometimes there isn't, but now tying it back into the latter points we made, especially when you are choosing a posek who you identify with ideologically, right? Even once you've done that, having a posek who's going to protect you by being opaque is still not, at a real level, giving up your authority, right? The reason that people turned to the Rav to ask him about women's learning was because they expected he would give an answer they would trust, and then by him being opaque, right, ironically, he actually strengthened their autonomy. Right, they wanted an answer from the Rav, and they wanted the strength to act on it without being subject to criticism. So they exercised their autonomy, their initiative by choosing him as their posek, and he protected them by protecting that decision by being opaque. Because now, when anyone would criticize them, they could legitimately say, "We asked the Rav." Right? We aren't making this decision ourselves. Our only decision was to choose the Rav, but now it's you against the Rav, not you against us. We don't even know what happened. Right, that first point of transparency versus opaque psak is totally, in many ways, or the implications of it are in many ways totally on how one chooses a posek. If one chooses a posek he trusts, then dafka, when he's being opaque in order to protect you and allow you to act based on the values that you both identify with, that in many ways has opened up autonomy by using the veil of authority. Okay? So that was the first unit of Shirim that we did, right? That was the topic of Asel Harav, of Marad Asra, of Chacham Echad Sha'asar, and what was in that unit?
We had the test case.
And the survey case, and then we got the test case. Right. Now, as a test case for this first unit, we brought the different tshuvot that deal with the authority of the chief rabbi, the chief rabbi of Israel, the whether or not they're binding. We saw that Rav Shaul Yisraeli bases himself very much on the sugya of Chacham Echad Sha'asar V'chadomeh, and thinks that the reason that Psak is binding is because you create, the Posek is imbued with the power to create halachic statuses, but the way they get that is by becoming your personal Rebbe. Now Rav Shaul Yisraeli, though, then makes the jump. What was the jump he made?
This applies even when you pick
the chief. Right, asserting that Eretz Yisrael has chosen the chief rabbinate and Rov has chosen it, and therefore it's binding, and you have given in, you've given up your authority, you've given up your ability to choose, because even if in theory, yes, Psak becomes binding because you choose the Posek, when you have a local Posek which has been accepted by many people, a majority of people, you become Batel, and you actually lose your initiative, your ability to make choice. Rav Aaron's critique was,
that's not true.
B'mitzius, that's not true, right? Because the role of the individual is so critical in Psak in terms of making it binding, that you actually have to establish personal authority. You have to establish that this person is your posek. It's not enough to assert things, right? If, in fact, authority began in the hands of the posek, and then he could impose that authority on individuals, then perhaps one wouldn't have to check the metzius. But if you assume, like Rav Yisraeli does assume, then at the end of the day, what makes Psak binding is the initiative of the non-poskim, the people who are asking the shailas, then you can't pretend that that authority exists. You actually need to establish it bashetach, and if you don't have that authority, then you don't have that authority, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that was really Ryan's critique, is that, leaving aside all the halachic arguments, the point is that you can't escape this point b'metzius. If Psak is binding because the lady made a choice, you have to establish that choice was made, or it just doesn't work. Now, we noted at that time that while this is one Kav Chashiva, there was another, and we saw that in Uri Dasberg's article on the topic, he does open up the possibility that under certain circumstances, the very existence of an authority figure creates mechuyavut on behalf of the constituency, even if they didn't necessarily choose him, and he derives that from the chiyuv tochacha, from the chiyuv of chinuch, and he notes that all that we've said is true to an extent, but it's not true in a vacuum, right? People who are, let's say, are qualified to be leaders, right? Even if no one chooses them as a leader, do have certain obligations to educate and give tochacha, and obviously to the extent that they have obligations, which therefore come with reciprocal obligations from the laity that are independent of the laity's choice of them, that would very much curtail the autonomy of individuals. But whether or not that's true is an interesting question. I mean, it's definitely true that there's a chiyuv of education, a chiyuv of tochacha. But that being the case, I don't think goes as far as he claims, which is actually, you know, creating de facto authority by a rabbi of an area. Right, the specific role within halacha of being a posek, that I think we can't escape the conclusion of Yisraeli and Rav Aaron, though they argue in the Metzias, that in the end of the day you need the people to agree. Okay, so that was the first unit. Yes? Bigadol? First unit that we did?
Yeah.
Okay. well, let's skip to three. Right? Okay. Then, later on we dealt with at different points. But the second question we dealt with is, okay, well, let's assume, the second question you really have to ask when you're trying to figure out what level of authority individuals have is, well, what things are fundamentally not even in the category of Psak, right? We noted the first question we asked was, okay, even when a posting is going to Paskin, and we're going to accept that he's acting as an authority figure, and the individual is not even trying to act as an authority figure, what types of questions are just not under the rubric of Psak, such that mimela individuals have authority, right? That a posek has no right to claim that his authority will curtail the rights of individuals. And we dealt with this at two different points. One, we dealt with it in our discussions of Das Torah, which we first did a background of Lotasser, but fundamentally we asked the question of Lotasser, which was Das Torah rather, which is, do poskim have authority outside of halachic matters, right? If you think that they don't, then there's obviously a tremendous amount of authority left in the hands of the laity, namely anything which doesn't count as a formal halachic question. If you take a very, very expansive sheet of Das Torah, then you've limited it because psak then pervades, you know, areas which are not classically halachic, and then, right, you, those levels therefore are at least subject to the potential authority of Rabbanim. Once that's the case, you have to ask, okay, well, to what extent? But one could just open up a tremendous amount of Jewish life to autonomy and not authority by simply denying any Das Torah argument and therefore putting many types of things outside of the scope of psak. In that context, we dealt with two questions, right? Two types of questions. Well, should we leave aside the halachic ones? We'll leave aside the halachic ones, right? We noted, oh, okay, for 1 minute, right? We noted the background to Das Torah is the authority of Lotasser in general, right? Who does it apply to? Does it apply only to the Sanhedrin HaGadol Yoshev Yerushalayim? Does it apply to the Gemara? Does it apply even to your local rabbinate? Why is it binding? Is it binding because we assume infallibility? Or is it binding despite the fact that we know they're not infallible? And that was the question we asked in Theory of Lotasser. Now those questions then translate into the sugya of Das Torah. We noted, right, that even if one thought that in theory rabbis had the authority over non-halachic matters, if you thought that authority was derived from Lotasser, and you thought Lotasser only applied to the Sanhedrin HaGadol HaYoshev Yerushalayim, or only to Chachmei HaTalmud, then despite the fact that in theory rabbis could weigh in on non-halachic matters, in practice they wouldn't have that authority. So in order to assume that Das Torah is a relevant category, you have to assume, first of all, that poskim have authority based on Lotasser or something else, Emunas Chachamim, or something else, and we noted the problems with some of these categories on non-halachic issues, and that that authority doesn't just apply to Sanhedrin or to the Gemara, but to any rabbi, any gadol, or any local rabbi. Within that context, the two questions are dealt with are sort of meta-social issues, right? Do poskim have authority over political issues, over communal issues, and then the second, you know, question is: do they have authority over mundane issues, like little petty personal issues? And we saw the range of opinions there. Right? We saw those who thought that all poskim throughout all generations have authority over even the most mundane of things because they're infallible. We saw the people who said that poskim through all generations have authority over even the most petty things, despite the fact that they are fallible, but they're the best we have. We saw people who thought that poskim have authority throughout the generations over important communal issues, which are value-laden, right? Not over petty issues, but over value-laden non-halachic issues, like politics or communal issues. And again, we saw those who said this was because they're infallible, or despite the fact that they are fallible, but they're the best we have. Then we saw the people at the opposite end of the spectrum who said poskim only have authority within the halachic realm, like Lawrence Kaplan goes in this direction. And we saw like Rav Aharon somewhere in the middle, where obviously the authority that poskim have over non-halachic issues is not as great as they have over halachic issues, but the fact is that things which are value-laden should be influenced by Torah position, and therefore they do have some level of authority. Now we saw that even within that, there was the extreme that Rav Aharon thought that the reason that they had authority was because they can combine Torah values with practical knowledge, and therefore their authority in non-halachic matters was derived from what?
Their knowledge of those matters.
At the opposite side of the spectrum, we saw the Chofetz Chaim and Rav Chanan and others who said that where does their authority come from in non-halachic matters?
Their knowledge of Torah.
their knowledge of Torah, Siyata Deshmaya, and therefore it was contingent on them not knowing the Metzias. Remember, we saw those passages. The less they know about reality, the more authority they have over it. So we dealt with all those details. But now coming to our sort of our summary and you know, boiling down what we got out of that, is that we saw sort of several very radically different perspectives about this fundamental question. Are there areas of life that are fundamentally left out of the hands of Poskim and significant ones, right? Let's leave aside the Shittos who think that Poskim have authority over, like, you know, monetary issues. Let's leave that aside because I don't want to, you know, I don't know how much weight to give that. But let's take political issues, right? Issues that are significant in our lives. If you think there's no death at all, then there are significant value-laden, Torah-value-laden areas of life that are simply not the realm of Poskim. In which case, even if one would come up with the most authoritative, limiting perspective of what pure Psak should look like, still religious life would have left a tremendous amount to the individual. And that would be what Siotze from totally rejecting Das Torah. And the other side of the spectrum, if you think that all issues that have any value, or even things that are mundane, are under the authority of our poskim, Bizman Hazeh, so then you have literally left no area of life that is not at some level heavily imposed upon by living external authorities, right? Not just God, like the theoretical authority, but like practical human authorities that are here Bashetach. And if you take the middle positions, so obviously, you have a middle perspective, right? You assume that, look, there are things where Poskim have more authority, there are things where Poskim have less. In case where they have less, right, laity should take more initiative in sort of engaging them in conversation and trying to elicit the values that they represent. But there's going to be that balance between the Poskim weighing in and providing Torah perspective and the decisions that people are going to make. So that was the first half of this question of scope. The second half, which we dealt with in three shiurim, was the question of are poskim responsible for poskening on reality, right? And here, the question I'm really dealing with is, okay, let's assume that poskim really are the last authority, or the last word in psak. Yes? Let's assume that. Still, all psak is made up of two factors, which is the theoretical halacha and what? Right, and the implementation, the reality to which on which you have to implement it. Now, if you think that poskim on both the halachic question, right, the halacha, the theoretical, the pristine, categories of halacha, but they don't poskim on the reality, so then even to the extent that poskim have authority, they haven't left non-poskim out of the process, because non-poskim are left to decide how halacha is implemented, right? They poskim become reservoirs of information, but they don't have the last word in applying halacha to reality. If you think that poskim actually weigh in on reality as well, so then, right, they're not just in charge of saying the halakha in theory, they're in charge of implementing it. So mimela, they actually make the decisions. Yes? We spent three shiurim on this. We noted that at the extreme, we have Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's claim, which was that poskim post-smicha, right, that poskim with smicha, the Sanhedrin, had authority over what?
Reality.
Right, both halakha and mitzias, right, halakha and lamaaseh. But post Sanhedrin, that's not true. Post-smicha, that's not true. So the result of that would be that Bizman Hazeh, Poskim would basically be Mara Makom Hulach, right? He would tell you the theoretical halacha, but in the end of the day, Balabatim, laity, would have the responsibility and ability to actually implement halacha without the jurisdiction of Poskim. Ravar noted that both on a fundamental level, this is very difficult, because while we noted that there's definitely a distinction between mitzius and halacha in theory, we saw several examples of this, such as, like, you know, can You know, we saw a Gemara that seemed to implement this distinction by claiming that it's not considered a ta'us of the Bezdin that is excusable if the Paskin, the Shabbos is over, that the sun has went down and it didn't. We saw a Poskim who said that Eliyahu can be Mevar Mitzios, even though he can't be Mevar Halacha, because that's not really part of the Halacha process. We did see people who thought this distinction existed. But on the other hand, it can't be true ad hasof. Poskim always have to weigh in reality. And not only does it weigh in reality, but as we noted, even if in theory one thought that distinction existed, poskim are often necessary to decide whether in fact something is a Mitzios question at all. Right? You know, we saw that, for example, in the Nishtanu Hatvaim issues, there are machlokot sometimes whether the Gemara was making a Mitzios claim at all or whether it was making a formal legal claim. And right, if you think, and we brought several other examples, but we noted that in practice, both because at some level poskim do have to have some level of authority over making decisions, and two, because it's often not clear whether something is actually a Mitzios issue, so to speak, or a halachic issue, it doesn't seem to be true at the radical level, though it does seem to be that poskim are more removed from the decision-making process in Mitzios than they are in theoretical halacha. And then we analyzed this in two different shiurim. In test cases, one was on the personal level, dealing with empirical reality, which specifically, what did we use?
Medicine.
And we noted that in medicine, you have the range of positions from people who think that, okay, you give it to the experts, and the experts assume, have to determine it formally, right, based on Rove v'chadome. People who assume that it's in the hand of experts, but it's not assumed formally, right? That is Machlokes Ramban and Ran we saw, and other Rishonim as well. But then you have the poskim who push back on this and say, well, in the end of the day, it may be true in theory that experts, that doctors are supposed to make medical assessments, but who decides whether they're telling the truth?
The posek.
The posek. And Mimela, they've taken authority back from themselves. We saw this started in the Tiferes Yisrael and his son and the Hilchos Gevurta and his Nifsak Lalach and the Ber Halacha and the Yafkid Yosef. So there you really do see a pushback on this notion that poskim are not responsible for determining reality. We then moved from that to from local empirical issues to national political issues. We spoke about Land for Peace, and there again we saw the whole range from people who thought that poskim should not determine the Mitzvahs at all, like Rav Aaron or Schechter, to people who thought that poskim were the only people who could determine reality, but because since they understand the values, they will be properly biased to see reality correctly, right? At the other extreme, that was, if you remember, Rav Malamud, right? And then people in the middle who, like, you know, Rav Shapiro, who said, look, it's poskim's job to pick the authorities, at least, right? Not necessarily make the decision themselves, but, you know, pick the authorities, or alternatively set up rules, like, you know, Hamotzi Mechaver Olav Araya or Sheva Al Tasa Adif, that Mimela will determine which outcome they want, regardless of how they... of how the experts weigh in. So, to summarize this unit, we noted that the second question one has to ask when balancing authority and autonomy in Psak is, well, what issues are Bechlal in the scope of Psak? And again, we dealt with Das Torah, which is a question of non-halachic issues. Are they fundamentally excluded from Psak or not? If they are, then that obviously opens up a tremendous amount of room for personal expression within a Torah life. If everything is under the auspices of Das Torah, that would very much limit the value of autonomy in religious life. And the second question was a more practical question, is if poskim don't have authority over reality, and by that we meant empirical reality, social reality, psychological reality, then even if they act as authoritative reservoirs of knowledge of theoretical halacha, the implementation will be determined by balabatim, which will mela give them a tremendous amount of space. If you think that's not true, then obviously poskim will have much more latitude in making decisions. So that was the second question that we dealt with. Okay? Yeah? Good? Okay. The third question that we dealt with was, all of these two cases, we're dealing with, one, where poskim don't even try to poskim, and two, cases which are not within the realm of psak. But now let's move to psak proper, where the next question we have to ask is, okay, this is in when poskim, well, this is when no one wants to poskim, or they want to make decisions on non-psak issues. But what happens when lady actually wants to poskim? Can you poskim for yourself? And there we noted there were two questions. One was the question of qualifications, and the second was the question of bias. So the second question, really, of bias, is a much more broad question, because it's not just asking what is the authority of laity in psak, it's asking what's the authority of anybody about himself, right? Bias is not a... Right? Bias is a problem whether you're a posek or not. And that's... it obviously affects this question, because if there's a technical problem, namely that no one has ever allowed a poskin for themselves, so then whether you're a posek or a non-posek, mimela, this prevents you from making your own decisions. So that was the question of bias, and we saw the range, right? We saw that most poskim in the end think that you are allowed to poskim for yourself unless it's unless you actually are biased. There are other poskim who thought that you weren't allowed to poskim for yourself if what? There was a cheskes isser, right? There was a, yes, remember this? There was a cheskes isser. You can't be motivated to cheskes isser. But again, Rav Avadia, many modern poskim thought that the standard psak is to assume you are allowed to poskim for yourself. We did see there was the Meiri who thought that you were never allowed to poskim for yourself because of bias, but that wasn't really the overwhelming majority of psak. And the second issue within that was, okay, even if you can poskim, are you able to establish psak? Right? Are you allowed to not just poskim for yourself, but establish psak by quoting a Mesora if you're biased? And we saw that in the end of the day, the way we poskim in the Ramah at least, is that as long as the information can be independently verified, this issue doesn't even exist, and therefore it really was limited to Mesorot rather than, you know, Svarot, which other people can argue on, or things that can be found in books, v'chadome. The more interesting question was the issue of poskim, of non-poskim poskining. Can you poskin for yourself? So there we noted that obviously the first most important thing is that you would be qualified. And then we discussed what it would mean to be qualified. We noted that there is a possibility that the levels of qualification necessary are different for yourself or poskening for others, or alternatively poskening for yourself and your family unit and for others. We noted that while many poskim do reject this, there is a kivun in poskim from the Orchos Chaim and the Rishon Lezion, in the Gilyan Marsha, in the Shulchan, in Urvazner, Vachadome, that in fact there's something unique about poskening for yourself that actually allows you to poskin with less qualifications. There's obviously not no qualifications. If you're just an Amaretz and you don't know how to poskin, then you can't poskin. But they did open this possibility that the qualifications are lower poskin for yourself. There's something about, and we said that this is presumably based on a second question, which is, in order for there to be a problem of poskening, it needs to be considered psak, right? And they suggested that when you're poskening for yourself, that might not really be psak in the formal sense, and therefore many of the problems involved in psak, such as mora halacha b'fnei rabo b'chadome, would be eliminated, in which case the qualifications would really be much lower, and you'd be able to poskening for yourself more often. So, in this unit, like we said, when we're actually dealing with the halachic process, when laity actually entering the halachic process, the first question they have to ask is the more general question, is, are you allowed to poskim for yourself because of bias? And that we saw that, again, the derech hamelech in poskim is to assume that you can. There are people who limit that either entirely, like the Meiri, or in cases of cheskes iser. But basically, poskim think that you are able to poskim for yourself. That doesn't mean it's a good idea, right? You obviously have to ensure that you're being... that you're being honest with yourself, you're not being biased, because otherwise that just leads to bad psak in general. But assuming you can overcome that problem, you'll be okay. The second possibility, which is more interesting, was the possibility that while there are many limitations on psak, such as qualifications, and mor halacha b'fnei rabo v'chadome, the qualifications that are necessary and external problems such as mor halacha b'fnei rabo v'chadome might be mitigated in the context of passing for herself, in which case giving you a lot more latitude. We did note that the Rishon LeZion said that even if that's the case, it wouldn't be true of a psak that is very, very public and affects others, right? Just because you're passing yourself doesn't give you the right to do something that's very public and has implications societally, even if not directly, nor does it allow you to do things that will have implications outside of yourself in a real way. And in those cases, you really do have to defer to authorities because, right, it's not your, you may have the right to make your own decisions, but assuming you're not an authority yourself, you don't have the right to make decisions for others. So that was question three. So those three questions taken together really was sort of the core of this, of the main part of this year, which is to what extent, right, what is the balance of authority and autonomy, in Psak, right? And we said, right, again, just to summarize in a sentence, that the laity has authority in choosing a posek, and we saw limitations. They have authority in cases that are outside the realm of psak to begin with. So, and that's the question of das Torah: is are there really things that are outside the realm of psak? And the question of do poskim pass in reality? And the third question is there is what cases do poskim actually do non poskim actually get to act as poskim? And that is limited by two factors: one is bias, and the second one is, you know, to what extent are they qualified? Are they allowed to pass them for themselves? And taken together, we tried to balance, and we saw that, you know, legitimately there is this tension between authority and autonomy in Psak, but it's just not true to say that authority is the only voice here. There is a tremendous amount of room for the individual when you put it all together. Okay, so that was one. That was the main unit divided into three parts. Yes, agreed. I think so. Okay. Like,
it is you be doing something,
yeah, right. We saw, like, you know, something which is minkar milsa, right? That was the lashon, right? Something that is a very public thing that other people will see, will be influenced by, or it's just a slap in the face, right? It's very, very public. It may not affect someone directly, but it's a slap in the face for the posek, for individuals to be weighing in on it, right? That was like the way the Rishon LeZion understood, right? The reason that we ask a chacham. For to check the knife, right, the shechita knife. And even though it's clearly passing for herself, it's a davar shel kavod. And if I took it for myself, right, that would be a shtuch to the posek. Okay, I realize I totally left out two shiurim here. Another question that we dealt with was, okay, this was all one unit. The second unit we dealt with is, okay, when poskim are paskining, to what extent do they have to take into account what the laity is doing, right? And that we dealt with in two levels. One is the question of formulation of law, and one was the question of determination of law, right? We noted in the level of formulation of law, we analyzed this through the limitations of the slippery slope argument, right? As Rav Shurlo presented them, right? That while poskim are given the task of protecting the Torah, of setting up siyagim and gedarim, they must take into account the effect of the people who are going to practice the law. And we noted that there are several principles that highlight that. For example, right? And, well, basically, Rav Shurlo said that whenever you have to set up gedarim, there are three things you have to take into account. What were they? Do you remember? Sikui, sikun, and... right? Right? It was the possibility, right, of how likely is it, the probability that the halacha would be violated, right? How egregious it would be if it were violated, and mechir, what is the cost on the people who have to live on it, right? Who have to live it. So he noted that those three factors can, there are several factors that, principles that highlight how we think about those. For example, he said, "Ein gozrin gzeira ala tzibur ela mechen rov tzibur chol lamud ba," clearly shows that no matter how high the cost, if people won't be able to live based on that halacha, Mimele it falls away because integral to the Halakhic system is that people are able to survive. He noted, Ein goshen gzeira l'gzeira. That even though it's important to protect the Torah, it's not worth inconveniencing people, limiting people to protect the protections, unless it's a davar which is really chamor. Right? We noted that davar shelo shchiach lo gazur bei rabbanan. Right? That it has to be something that's very high, that's very probable. If it's not probable, it's not worth limiting people. So that's in the case of formulation of law. And what Rishurlo highlighted very, very strongly is that when it comes to formulating law halacha in a very real sense, well, yes, it cares about protecting Torah, and the more likely an Isser will be violated, the more likely we'll set up a gzeira. And the worse the Isser is, the more likely we'll set up a gzeira. In the end of the day, the halachic system is mishubad to those who keep it, and therefore, we're not going to formulate a law that that people can't handle. And we noted that at some level this is true on d'oraisas as well, not that we can affect d'oraisas, but that the way Chazal understand d'oraisas is, right, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bav Etzron Yom B'Yosef, Hashem wouldn't set up a mitzvah that we can't handle, Lo Dibur Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara, right, there are d'oraisa principles that show that Hashem himself built into the halakhic system the possibility of us keeping it. So that was in terms of formulation of law. The second issue we dealt with on that level was not a formulation of law, was determination of law, where we noted that there's this notion that im einim nevi'im heim, b'nei nevi'im heim, or im halacha rufefes biyadecha puk chazi mayav adavar, when you don't know what the halacha is, assume that people are getting it right. And we noted that there are limitations on it, that in Ashkenaz, you do have people who really go very far, and they assume that minhag is always right, and that in the end of the day, they assume that laity is following halacha, and that affects their termination of psa'at. But it's not all the time, right? Sometimes you have the balitosas bending over backwards, and late Ashkenaz, you have Yisrael of Krems and the Hagos Ashri saying, I've never seen a minhag we don't pask. And like at the other end of the expression, you have cases where Rabbeinu Tam says, minhag equals gehenom, right? And we noted that it's hard to pin it down, but it's clear that the more mesupik you are about halacha, the more likely you are to take popular practice as a determining factor. The more people have sacrificed for that, or the more you assume that people are from and are therefore doing something right, the more likely you are to assume that halacha follows what people are doing. If you don't trust your laity, so then it's unlikely that you're going to think what they're doing is correct. and so what we did was try to balance those factors. So, you know, we didn't come to, let's say, we weren't Kovei Masmer, we didn't come to strong conclusions, but we did notice that there is that balance, that the more we assume that people are doing something right because they're from people, the more they've sacrificed for it, the less convinced we are about the halacha psuka, the more likely we allow minhag to determine what halacha is, the less we trust people's personal religiosity, the lower the stakes, the less likely we are to give up sort of text knowledge in favor of minhag. So that unit was not about the role of poskim of a non poskim directly in the halachic system, but rather was what is the effect of what people do on the halachic process. And we saw that halacha really both at some level under certain circumstances assumes that people are from, and that affects how we determine halacha, and halacha, because of the basic assumption that it's meant to be lived, the any halacha that would make it impossible to live is highly limited we are highly limited as postgame in our ability to impose it, which does highlight a very central role to the people who keep halacha in the process, and not just, you know, sort of this theoretical halacha. As a sort of bracketed shear in that context, we dealt with Mutav Shishog again, where Mutav Shogun is not directly dealing with it, but it's the same similar issues, right, where we saw that in Mutav Yishogin, you're trying to balance our achrayas to the Torah, right, to being mocha, to ensure that people are educated and that the proper Torah is kept, with our responsibility to people, you know, people who are shogeg, to not to turn them into mizidin. And we saw that how poskim navigate these two poles really does highlight the same tension, between, on the one hand, our responsibility towards the Torah, and the other hand, our responsibility to the people keeping the Torah. And for example, right, the limitations we saw, that leaders have more of responsibility on the macha education front. Individuals have more of responsibility to their fellow person. So for leaders, we're less likely to say mutafshi shog again. People who said, well, it depends. If it's a door of Rasha'im, so we saw people who say that there you have to be mocha even more, because at that moment I have no responsibility to the people, because they've given up on the halacha, I have more responsibility to the Torah to ensure that it's protected as much as possible. To people saying the opposite, no, if everyone's Rasha'im, it's going to be ineffective, right? So it's not worth turning them into mezidin. Again, they're highlighting that the mechuyavut to the people and not to the to sort of the theoretical halacha, as it were. So while that didn't directly deal with our question, it does highlight the same tension where the halacha system is always ne'eman to two things: to the theoretical halacha and to what people are doing b'shetach, and we have to balance balance the values and the commitments we have to both to come out with a happy medium. Were those, I think, the last main issues, and then we dealt with two small cases? Is that right? I think so, right? Right? I mean, I'll do these two, and if we missed something, I'll go back. Right? The last two shirim we dealt with were on very specific cases, where we noted that there are at least two cases where it seems like individuals are given the possibility of circumventing the system, right? One was in the realm of ne'emanut, where we noted, well, normally a chashur al hadavar is not ne'eman, based on the Gemara that thinks in the case of Bezdin, I can say Kimli, that I trust Reuven, or I trust my wife, as if it were yediyah atzmi. There's, right, Ramosha Feinstein and others extend this to regular realms of ne'emanut, which shows that at some level, while halacha is very formal, and halacha does have formal requirements, there is that possibility that sometimes personal conviction is going to be able to circumvent the formal strictures of halacha. And that's really what Rav Moshe says, that if I believe my non-firm relatives to say that something's kosher, even though halachically they shouldn't mean eman, I'm allowed to count it as yediyah atzmi, which really does highlight that ability of people to trust themselves sometimes in the face of formal law. We dealt with the pratim of that. Who does it extend to? Can I extend my knowledge to you? Can I have Kimli to Kimli? Or can my Kimli extend to my family unit, to my friends, etc.? Which again tests the limit of this principle, right? Even if we assume that my personal conviction can circumvent the halacha, can it circumvent it for you? Can it circumvent it for many people? And we saw the limitations on that. Last week, what we dealt with was the rule of Kimli and Dine Mamonos, which at first glance, right, the notion that I can say Kimli kind of kaktos against the Nesivos, when Bezin Pas the Nesivos, seems to run the risk of laity being able to overturn any possibility of authority in Dine Mamonos. By simply saying I pasken like other people, we dealt with the fundamentally, how does it work? Is it through, because of Motzi Mechavrela Haraya? Is it because of Tvisa, Kim, Barili, Avid Inish Din Lafshei, the Chadome? But we noted that whatever it's based on, if it really was true Arasof, and there was a point that Arachasholchan made when he totally rejected it from Halacha, the Yom Betumim made it, the Chadome, if it were really true that someone could simply say, I pass like a Tzios against the Nesivos, and therefore I pass against Bezdin, at least in Dine Mamonos, there would be no such thing as authority, right? Everybody would be able to literally destroy the halachic system by finding some shita that they found in Bar Ilan and paskining for themselves, mimela, right? Again, whether that power was given to them because of a technicality that hamotzi mechaveru olav araya and all I have to do is create a suffix, is an interesting question, but the point is that if it was true, then I could really practically overturn the halachic system in its entirety. But as we noted, no posek think that's possible, right? It's impossible to think that an individual can't overturn the halachic system. They can't be. The fact is, there is choshen mishpat, there is law, and it can't be that someone's ability to look something up in Bar Ilan allows them just to overturn the system. And therefore, we saw the poskim really put limitations on it, and if I had to summarize all of them in a sentence, it would be anything which is rejected from halacha, you can't claim kimli. Kimli is limited to things that are within the realm of open questions. That being the case, it doesn't give you much room. All it does is basically say, when there's a machlokes, under certain circumstances, we won't be motzi mamon. And therefore, kimli, while at first glance might seem to destroy dine mamonos and destroy the notion of authority and give total power to the individual, we noted that no posek really accepts it because that's an absurd conclusion. It just can't be the case. So I think, well, those are all the shirim we dealt with? This Chumrah. Oh, thank you. Thank you. So those were many of the issues we dealt with. Right? Again, dealing with what is the role of non-poskim in choosing poskim, what issues are not under the rubric of psak, when can individuals actually enter into the halakhic process proper. Then we dealt with what is the mechuyavut of the halakhic process to the people who keep it, both in formulation of law and in determination of law. Then we brought two circumstances in which people's personal conviction seemed to be able to circumvent law. One really circumvent in the case of ne'amanos. The other one at least just allow you to rely on some other position. But we saw that's only in very limited circumstances. And you're right, the last thing we dealt with was chumrah. Now, chumrah is in some ways unique to this because it's a case where undeniably the individual has authority. Right, it's a case which is not halachic, or not purely halachic, where people have the ability to create their own religious experience. So what we dealt with in that case is, okay, it's clear that there is such a thing called chumrah. In that particular case, there's almost no question that the fundamental issue there is autonomy, and I have the right and ability to create my own halachic categories. Right, we could have talked about neder for the same reason. The bigger question we have to deal with in chumrah is, when is that a good idea? Right, naniach you can do it, right, but when is it a good idea? And we saw several possibilities. If I had to divide them, there was a whole kav chashiva that thought chumras are only a good idea if they represent a positive value, right? A positive, non-obligatory value. For example, it makes sense for a woman to keep a mitzvah saseh shezman grama because it's an objective value, they happen not to be chayav. Or, it makes sense for me to eat in the sukkah, to drink water in the sukkah because I just am patur, but if I do go, there's a kiyum. Or, we saw from, I think it was the Pesach Einayim, who said that anything which is mitzvah ben al-mechabero, chumrah is a good thing because it's always nice to be nice, right? It's always positive. Or the Meiri, who said that anything which has yesh bo davar musar is a good chumrah. Right? So the first kav chashiva is, look, when you are creating your own religious experience, that's always a good idea if there's objective reason why one would do it. If there's objective reason, then great. You're not obligated to do it, but if you want to, here are all these positive values that you can choose to take upon yourself. There are other people who are even more expansive and say, no, we don't even require you to explain why what you're doing is a good idea. What do we need to prove why?
It's not a bad idea.
It's not a bad idea. It's not usher. And those posts can focus on, you can be machmir if there's no yuhara. As long as there's no yuhara, or as long as other people aren't going to be misled, right? Or as long as you aren't going to hurt somebody in the process, or something like that, right? There's a whole nother line of thought that goes even farther and says, no, it's not just when something's positive. You can decide to have religious experience which is not objectively valuable, as long as it's not negative. The only limitation is that you can't do something wrong toch kidei. So that's really the second group of people in terms of what they thought, what legitimate chumros are. We noted in that context that there are chumros, right? There are chumros that I'm trying to go lifnim mishur hadin. Then there are chumros where I'm trying to be machmir for a position, right? Being machmir for a position could be better or worse, right? It could be better because there's a very good reason why it would be machmir. I'm really not sure it's not the halacha p'suka. On the other hand, it could be worse because that could lead to yuara, right? I think you're posthuming wrong. It could be motzi la'az on others. We dealt with other details, but again, the two main perspectives, I think, in Chumrah are those who think that you're able to create religious experience if there's an objective value, and those who think that you're allowed to create religious experience even if there is an objective value, as long as there's not a negative problem, as long as there's not a problem that's being created by you being too frum. Shall we say, we saw, I think, like 11 different positions. And the specific way that we balanced it was, right, how do we balance kol patur min hadavar v'osei nekra hedyot with kol machmer tavo lo bracha? When does each of them apply? Okay, so I think those were all the shurim that we dealt with. And again, right, so just right one last time, right, we summarized, right, that non-poskim, at the end of the day, right, have a tremendous amount of authority in choosing a posek, probably. There are many areas of life where psak may or may not apply, or may apply to a lesser extent. The issues of das Torah, reality, v'chadome. There are cases where people are to poskin straight for themselves, as long as they're not biased. Even when poskim are not, even when poskim are the one poskining, they're taking to effect the laity's actions in their real life, both in formulating and determining law. We noted that there are some circumstances where non-poskim can circumvent the law, which really does de facto give them authority, such as in Kimli Yigave and Kimli in general by Dini Mamonos. And the last thing is that beyond all of this, right, there is clearly a category where people can assert their own independence and form their own religious experience, which is the realm of Chumrah. But then, right, there still are two basic schools of thought: those who think that you're only allowed to create your own religious experience where there's independent value, and those who think no, you can even create religious experiences for yourself where there's no independent value or objective value, as long as it isn't hurting other people or hurting some other Torah value. Taken together, right, I think, you know, we've sort of drawn this spectrum and tried to really analyze the role of Balabat in the halachic process, and we've seen that there, you know, despite the fact that halacha is in many ways an authority-based system, a system that values heteronomy, there is a lot of role for the individual.